What you've just said is a little bit like a policeman saying to the victim of a horrible crime, "Look, look, let's rise above this, okay? Let's just go halves with the criminal here," because for all sorts of reasons, I think Brexit is, tantamount to a kind of a crime against our country, and for the following reasons.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Now, regular listeners will know that we usually have free topics on current affairs, politics and social issues that we go through, but this is going to be one of our interview specials. And in this case, we are joined by AC Grayling. Most of you will be familiar with him already, but he's the founder and principal of the New College of the Humanities at Northeastern University London, and he's also the professor of philosophy there. He's written many books over the years, The God Argument, Democracy and Its Crisis, The History of Philosophy, and he's got a new book out, which came out yesterday, the 3rd of February, For the Good of the World, where he asks, is global agreement on global challenges possible? So a small topic, I think, for us to tackle here, Jazza.
Yeah, nice and easy. We thought we'd have some softball questions with our guest. It's lovely to meet you, Anthony.
That's a great pleasure to be on your show with you.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. We wanted to start off just by, I mean, in some ways, I think it's obvious what the answer to this is, but why have you decided to write this book now?
Because the challenges are not being addressed. And that's obvious from what happened in Glasgow at the end of last year. A lot of talk, but a very serious problem that the world faces, the climate challenge, not really being dealt with properly. And all the usual problems, namely the competition between different states, different governments, countries not wanting to fall behind in competitive advantage with other countries. But I also mention in the book the tremendous challenge being posed by the hugely rapid technological advances we're witnessing at the moment, many of which, of course, are very positive, but some of which are bit complicated. Let me just mention one so it kind of sets it up. It's so easy for people to fall into conspiracy theories and science fiction, but these things are really, really happening. And the example in question is the fact that brain chip interface technologies in neuroscience are already on stream, are already happening. And this is marvelous because if you can have a chip implanted that would help with epilepsy or Parkinson's disease, traumatic memories, or terribly depressive moods, that would be wonderfully welcome. But you can see it takes no thought at all to recognize that these very same technologies could be used for very different purposes, malign purposes. If you can control memory and mood, for example, that could be problematic. That's just one example of many technologies which are coming on stream that we need to think about, and we're not thinking about them. And finally, I don't want to go on for too long, but the third problem that I address in the book is that the deficit of rights and of justice, especially economic justice in our world. And my argument is that this third problem is the reason for the first two problems. I mean, they're all connected. It's the result of the fact that we are in such a state of competition and the conflicts that competition sometimes leads to that we simply can't get global agreement together. And that's something that we need to be alert to, and we need to be thinking about ways to overcome it.
It certainly seems, especially when you're talking about technology as kind of like one of the great challenges that we have, it makes me think of all of those videos and examples of the Zuckerbergs and his ilk being interviewed by members of the Senate and the House of Representatives in the US, and people who are making these decisions about kind of like legislation and stuff clearly not understanding the technologies that are so ubiquitous in our lives at the moment. Democracy, you have an optimistic kind of like conclusion, right, to kind of like democracy being the one of the solutions to kind of like all of these problems, but how do we make sure that people who are equipped to understand and to properly legislate for these things are in the positions to be able to do so?
Well, I'm pleased that you thought that I was being optimistic in that concluding chapter there, because
Cool, okay.
I wish I could be, because I'm very careful to say that a kind of idealized solution is for electorates around the world to be well informed, as to address the point you just raised there, and that they would have the means, the mechanism, the kind of systems of representation which would result in genuine influence on governments, thus forcing governments to talk to one another properly, act maturely in a grown-up way, deal collectively with all these problems. But I describe it as an idealized solution because, alas, it's altogether too likely that it will only materialize when or after some of these problems become practically unmanageable. That's the great difficulty. But the preceding difficulty is the one that you've identified, and that is getting people to be informed. Because after all, pluralities in electorates, that's to say majorities, or collections of minorities constituting a majority on this particular issue are as short-termist as governments are, as self-interested, as unprepared to make any kinds of sacrifices, for example, on consumption or travel and the rest, that would help towards dealing with these problems. So, we've got a huge mountain to climb here. We've got to get the argument won with individuals and groups, and we've got to get those individuals and groups to exert some control over governments.
You sort of outline the beginnings of a solution, I think, towards the end of your book, which Jasra has just referred to, and you've just referred to there. In practical terms, how do you think you'd go about educating a population or improving the levels of understanding about, say, climate change or the two other problems you've looked at in your book?
Well, of course, the effort to do this has been going on for some time now, and most of the people involved in it feel as if they're screaming into the wind because far too few people are listening to them, least of all people in positions where they might be able to do something about it. So that's people in government. So I suppose your podcasts, the books that I write, and all the efforts that everybody is making to say, look, wake up, there are these very serious problems, and this is the nature of the problem. Because do you know what? I mean, a really interesting thing is that you can say to people, okay, there's a challenge. So, we're warming the climate, and this is going to be disastrous. So you say that to them, and they say, oh dear, well, that doesn't sound too good, or I don't believe it, or something, and then they go their way. But when you dig into the details, and this is how best to do it, of course, you get into the details, say to them, okay, look, we're now on track for nearly 3 degrees of warming by the end of this century, and it could be more because these climate changes have a kind of series of trigger effects or cascade effects that when you get to a certain point, suddenly other problems start to arise, like, for example, releasing methane gases because of thawing of the permafrost. So the problems are kind of incremental. They get worse and worse as time goes by. So you could even get to 4 degrees by the end of the century. That would be utterly catastrophic because great swathes of the world would be uninhabitable because of droughts and extreme weather events and flooding and drowning of coastal regions and islands. And that means hundreds of millions of people being displaced, hundreds of millions of refugees pouring across borders or into countries where there's still a bit of food. Just imagine that. And this could be happening in the lifetime of people alive today, certainly our children and grandchildren. Think of that. Now, if you can make it that vivid, if you can, describe what the actual effects would be like, you might get people to sit up and take notice. Because even though the prospect of preventing that is preventing something that could happen in 50 years' time, let's say, it's not going to be preventable unless we do something about it now. I mean, now in 2022, now in 2010, now back in 1997, which is when the Kyoto Climate Agreement was arrived at. So, to get the sense of urgency across requires real information. It also, by the way, requires, again, I'm banging on a bit here, but it requires being really imaginative and looking across the palette of concerns. I mean, one thing I just mentioned sort of in passing in the book is who's worst affected by climate change events like flooding? Well, women. Why? Because so many women around the world, especially in those parts of the world where climate effects are going to be most serious, so in developing countries, for example, so many women in those parts of the world can't swim. They wear clothes that would hamper them if they get caught in a flood. they are the people upon whom fresh water or drinkable water supplies depend, because many of them have to walk miles to get it every day. Those water supplies would be polluted. Or if they have to walk even further to get those supplies, they become more vulnerable to attack and you know, discriminatory actions and so on. So you can see how there's this kind of, you know, generation of ill effect after ill effect after ill effect, ramifying out and affecting all sorts of people in different ways, which it takes imagination to see. And the project of trying to educate people about this is trying to get them to get a vivid enough imagining of the scenario for them to be motivated to do something about it.
You talk a lot in your book about what you call Grayling's Law, which is you also describe as a law of self-interest. So, you know, if I think it comes in two parts. The latter part is if somebody has a good reason not to, you know, is able to prevent action and their self-interest dictates that they want to prevent the action, they will do so. And you see that in the sort of foot dragging of energy companies when it comes to renewable energy and so on. There seems to be a lot of things in human nature that would make it difficult for us to change how we think. I mean, you kind of referenced there that if you make something vivid enough to somebody, then they're likely to actually take action rather than just, you know, reading them out statistics or whatever. But is there an element of pessimism in your analysis that this would be possible because of the kind of fundamental human nature?
Unfortunately, there is an element of pessimism there, but the whole point about pessimism is that you can't yield to it. I mean, if you did, you'd go for the nearest high building and jump off it, wouldn't you? So what you've got to do is you've got to try as hard as possible to accentuate the positive, as the old song had it, however difficult it might be, because you never know. I mean, the unexpected does happen, in the sense that if there were a big enough impact from something, and maybe the pandemic is one example of this, because it illustrates how desperately we need to understand a couple of things. We desperately need to understand how important it is for there to be international cooperation to deal with it, like, for example, production and distribution of vaccines. The distribution part, of course, being very patchy and problematically so. But we also learn other things. We learn, you know, who are the really important people in a time of crisis like the pandemic? Well, so-called key workers, the lowest paid, doing the most menial jobs in society, that they are essential. We couldn't survive without the people who delivered our food and our supplies. Whereas billionaires, on the whole, are pretty dispensable. So you can see that we can get shifts of perception when big things happen and challenging things happen. And one, therefore, must always maintain a kind of flicker of optimism, even though the situation at the moment doesn't look great.
I feel like hearing you, because broadly, public opinion and how informed the public are has been going in a direction that more and more understands the severity of, especially with stuff like climate change, but the severity of the issues that we're facing is kind of like a human race on this planet. Isn't our issue now time? Because it's taken so long for us to get to a point where there is such kind of like public consciousness around these issues, but now that it's ticking, like we only have a certain amount of time before the consequences of stuff like climate change are irreversible and have huge kind of like impacts on the human population and the world we live in. How do you square that with kind of like the lack of time that we have, but the time that we need in order to build up this knowledge in the wider population? Because I'm stuck, Anthony, and I'd like your help.
Well, look, you're right about that. It is it's not the only problem, but it is an important problem, the problem of time, because in one sense, of course, on the climate thing, as on the technology thing, and you know, we need to dig into the technology thing a little bit, because What one example of that is the development of new kinds of weapons systems, into which hundreds of billions of dollars have been invested over the last 20 or so years. And this is, you know, destabilizing the world and transforming the landscape there in very serious ways. So already in that respect, you know, things are already a bit too late. And that can be said about the climate problem as well. We're already past a number of significant turning points on which there is no going back. So that our problem now is not stopping climate change, it's mitigating it or adapting to it. And mitigation and adaptation are two very, very different things. They mean there are big problems on the way, and we've got to start thinking, which we haven't really properly done yet, thinking about how we're going to live with them. But you're dead right. So it is a time issue. And, you know, time has ticked away already. So we're, every day, every minute really is getting us further and further beyond the tipping point. But there are two other issues. You are right to say that public awareness and understanding has increased. In fact, it's increased quite a lot, really, since Paris, I would say, in the last 10 or 12 years. But the question to be asked about that is it enough? Is it widespread enough? Is it people who read newspapers, listen to your podcast, are a little bit sort of woke on these issues, who are getting more concerned about it? Hence, you know, we get forms of activism arising, which are much, much more focused on this issue. So is it enough? That's the first question. And the second question is, even if it were enough, is it able to do what public opinion should do, and that is translate through the ballot box into government and therefore into action in enough places in the world? Now, my argument is that if the G7 countries, or the big economies of the world, were to get their act together and bring some pressure on China and Russia to come along with them, then something might be done. But our systems, our democratic systems around the world, even in the UK and the US, Canada, India, places like that, are actually not responsive enough. They're not democratic enough. We only live in partial democracies. And an example of that is, you know, first past the post system here, a first past the post voting system for House of Representatives in the US.
Oh, you don't have to convince us of PR, Anthony. We're already on board. it's a pet subject for us.
This is a really, really crucial issue. So I got somebody criticizing the other day for saying, oh, so your solution to the world's problems is PR. And the answer is, pretty well, actually, because if we had it, we might get a decent government. And if we had decent government, we might be able to tackle some of these problems.
A kindred spirit, very much. You're very welcome on this podcast.
is your view about proportional representation, is that something that you thought about for sort of decades past, or is it something that's, you know, is it something that's become more obvious to you that it needs reform in the last 5-10 years, given Brexit and, you know, the current dysfunctions of our government?
It's decades. I've been interested in it as a simple matter of logic. I mean, it seems absolutely incredible that governments, for example, in this country, should be based on very small percentages of total electorates. Think of the 2019 election, 43% of votes cast for Conservatives, giving them a massive 80-seat majority. And therefore, you know, we're in a one-party state now, as often happens in elections here. But that 43% of votes cast represented 29% of the electorate. I mean, it's completely shocking that these neo-Tories, because this isn't really the Conservative Party of Dominic Grieve and Chris Patten and people like that. You know, this is a whole new animal under Johnson, should be doing what it's doing or failing to do or what it's failing to do on such a small popular support. And it's unacceptable. In the United States, we see the plurality system there, the first-past-post system, produces a complete paralysis, because it generates, as most such electoral systems do, a two-party divide. They vie with one another to get their hands on the levers of power. The opposition between them becomes very bitter. It's incredibly divisive. Political discourse becomes sloganizing and you know, mutual taunting and finger-pointing. And so you get huge swathes of the population. All the gradations of interest and need in the population completely silenced. And this is crucial. It's crucial that this should be reformed at this juncture in the world's history, precisely because of these dangers that the world faces.
I'm thinking that we had I think it was 2011, we had the alternative vote referendum in this country, and it was rejected, I think, by 2/3 of those who cast a vote in that ballot. So it doesn't appear as though there's necessarily appetite for it. And, you know, given that the Conservatives are in power with an 80-odd seat majority, and they're very resistant to it, I would personally not be very hopeful that's going to change anytime soon. What do you think?
No. This is where you do need a bit of optimism, because For one thing, the alternative vote is not proportional representation. Secondly, it was a very milksop sort of suggestion, which the Conservative major partners in the coalition didn't want. Therefore, they did everything they could possibly do to undermine it, certainly didn't back it, put it on a local elections day when there's a very small turnout. Nobody was informed about why it was necessary or how it would work properly, and therefore it was bound to fail. And it's exactly what the Conservative members of the coalition wanted, because it used to be thought, and it's no longer true, that referendums are one in a generation. So this kicked it into the long grass, and that's the end of the story. But since 2016, I think appetite has changed completely. We're in a completely new situation now, and PR, the time for PR is coming. It didn't exist in 2011. It's certainly on the move now. So you should be optimistic about it, because just think about the following scenario. You know, if we got either a progressive alliance, unlikely, or really functional tactical voting, and we got the Conservatives out and we got in a hung parliament in which Lib Dems and Greens and SNP and Plaid, with all of them with a very big interest in PR, and making a condition of entering a coalition or giving, you know, comfort and supply to a minority government, then we will get PR. And when we get PR and we get a reform parliament, you know, all bets are off. This is going to be a changed environment in which there will be many, many more voices, many, many more agreements and selections from across the palette of needs in our society, in a way which will be very different from how things are now. Because how things are now is you get one faction, one political party into power, and obviously would be illogical otherwise. It is going to do things that favour its main support. And therefore, government is not government of the people. It's government for the people who support you. And that's bad. That we see that is bad. Brexit is a perfect example of this. And the pandemic mismanagement is another example of this, that we need government which is for all the people. That's coalition government. That's PR.
And as we know, Brexit was all Jimmy's fault. So may that be on your shoulders, Jimmy. This is kind of like a bit of a more of a fun question than anything. Is there any country that has a form of PR that you think is the most appropriate, kind of like the most functional? Like, there's lots of different interpretations of proportionate representation across the world, aren't there? What's your favourite?
All right, two preliminaries, okay? Firstly, there are some very, very bad examples of PR which people keep dragging out and citing. Italy and Israel both have really bad systems of PR which make the tail wag the dog every time. So very, very small parties have an overweening influence on what happens in the legislature. Now, it is not outwith the witch of humankind to devise PR systems which are a bit more functional than that. Okay, so let's just mention them to set them aside. Second preliminary is, nothing in human affairs outside, you know, your podcast is perfect. Okay? nothing is perfect. You cannot expect any system of government or of representation to be perfect. You can only be meliorist about it. You can't be perfectibilist about it. So I would point to some of our major EU friends and partners where the systems in question produce more consensual government, and therefore more stable government. Now, you will get people saying, look at the Netherlands. They had an election in the spring last year, and they formed the government just before Christmas. So, you know, this was because of all the horse trading and all the different parties debating and negotiating and saying who will be in and who will be out. And this is pointed to as a bad thing. I point to it as a very, very good thing. It's a very good thing because there's a terrific discussion about how all the interests and needs and concerns in that society, represented by a number of different organizations, parties, voices, all of them, they're somehow or other some form of consensus. It's always going to be imperfect, but some form of consensus is going to be arrived at, so that the resulting government, after a lot of discussion and about a lot of, you know, measurement of what's really important in that country for all the plurality, diversity of opinion in it, will get some kind of voice in the government when it's finally formed. In my view, that's a very good thing. And we should be we should be sort of open to that. We should say, okay, let's have a look at what that great range of opinion in the country is. Then let's sit down, let's work out a program which is genuinely for everybody.
In order for kind of like something like PR to work, you need there to be compromise and consensus in some kind of way. Like you're trying to serve the majority of the population in some way, shape or form. I look at kind of like people who are on our side of the Brexit argument and who... I sometimes look at kind of like some of the ways that Brexiteers are talked about, and like I'm lucky because some of my favourite people are Brexiteers, and so they are they are humanised for me. And a lot of the rhetoric around it by, especially kind of like the Remainiac form of kind of like Remainers, is quite disgenerous to a lot of the people who voted Brexit, of course, to the people who ran the campaign. How? I don't know. I'd just love to hear you speak to that, because you have FBPE in your profile, and you've certainly been very good at kind of like taking down like falsified arguments of Brexiteers and stuff like that. Do you not think that fissure in our society at the moment is something that we need to rise above as Remainers if we're going to be able to find some kind of consensus going forward, even if it's something along the lines of us making do with the fact that we're outside of the EU, at least for now?
You know, firstly, I will confess, if anybody's in any doubt about it, that I am a Romaniac. You, okay, not just a Romania, but you can put a power of three there. What you've just said is a little bit like policeman saying to the victim of a horrible crime, look, let's rise above this, okay? Let's just go halves with the criminal here, because for all sorts of reasons, I think Brexit is tantamount to a kind of a crime against our country, and for the following reasons. First, The whole idea of the EU, the whole concept, which was begun after the Second World War, after hundreds and hundreds of years of incredible bloodshed and strife and competition within Europe, the founding fathers of the coal and steel union to begin with, and then the EEC, then the EU, were persuaded by arguments that had been put forward by Tom Paine in the late 18th century and by Cobden and Bright and the free traders of the 19th century and so on, that you will get peace between nations if you make their relations with one another very intimate through trading, through exchange, and through getting to know one another. And it's just impossible for them to go to war with one another. That was the argument, and that was the hope predicated on which the whole European project was predicated. It's a peace movement, and it's a movement about sharing values and about building something. Now, the EU is a very imperfect institution. It's in great need of reform. It's got lots of flaws, but this is because it's a work in progress. It doesn't take an evening to build something like a great federation of states and so on, without it being a work of long breath, as the French would say. I mean, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of thought, a lot of building. The success of the EU in the time that it has existed is phenomenal, given all the difficulties that it's had to face. The EU is something that has rescued the UK. I mean, you guys are far too young to remember the 60s and 70s.
Stop it, Anthony.
Despite my youthful appearance, unfortunately. I can remember 3-day week power cuts, unburied bodies, piles of rubbish in the streets, Chancellor of the Exchequer going off to the IMF with his begging bowl. You know, I can remember what absolute basket case this country was in, rescued by joining the EEC and then the EU. I mean, where we got to by 2016, even with the austerity measures introduced after 2010 and so on, where we had got to was remarkable in comparison to the very, very severe competitive and comparative decline that this country had suffered after pretty well being bankrupt by the Second World War and losing an empire and et cetera, et cetera. So join those two things together, the ideals that are involved in the EU project on the one hand, on the fact that we were rescued from a dire situation by joining up and that we benefited from it. Add to that the fact that I'm, you know, the sort of person who I enjoy the music, the art, the thought, the philosophy, the literature of our European homeland. And how many people here don't like Beethoven or Michelangelo or, you know...
The Eurovision Song Contest.
Eurovision Song Contest, absolute acme. Yeah. You can see how the idea of being insular, inward-looking, turning your back on all that is somehow... There's something craven about it, which I don't like. And then my final point is that the 2016 referendum provably was based on lies and on deceit, provably, number one. Number two, is profoundly contrary to any kind of constitutional principle. Now, of course, invoking the constitution in this country is a joke because we don't really have one. We've got an uncodified constitution, which has been very well described as a set of understandings that nobody understands. That's very handy for politicians because they can play ducks and drakes with it. You only need to look at the referendum itself. Every referendum held in this country since 1972, which was when the first referendum was, has been held on a different basis. So, you know, was there going to be a threshold or not? Was there going to be mandating or not? Et cetera. So the 2016 referendum resulted in a 51.89% of actual votes cast, representing 37% of the total electorate. 37% of the total electorate, representing 26% of the population of these islands, the will of the people, joke, right there, okay? Now, 37% of the electorate. If you want a legal strike, your trades union has to produce a minimum of 40% of the total membership of the trades union for the strike to be legal. Why that threshold? Because there has to be enough of a consensus for it to count as a legal strike. We have a Parliament Act in force at the moment, no doubt soon to be repealed. But that Parliament Act says that if there's to be a general election outside the five-year terms of the Parliament, there has to be agreement of 66%, a supermajority, 66% of all sitting MPs for that to happen. Now, why a 66% supermajority or a 40% minimum threshold in the trades union case? Because of the possibility of the kinds of changes that might follow. That you need enough agreement, you need to get as much consensus as possible to ensure that people will be able to put up with the changes that will flow. To go for a huge, huge historical change in the constitutional and international arrangements of this country on the base of 37% of the total electorate was, and put it bluntly, in terms of constitutional principle, an absolute crime, a coup, really. And after the referendum, when all sorts of efforts were made by Romaniacs like me to get the thing stopped, and we went to court about it, for example, a judge said, and this is on the record, that if this had been a mandating referendum, it would have to be voided. This is because of the illegalities committed by the Leave EU, both the Leave campaigns, in fact. We are now witnessing this huge cost of living crash, massive inflation of fuel prices, a real problem where those folk I mentioned earlier, you know, the key workers, are paying because our country is not economically resilient enough to deal with the economic effects of COVID because of Brexit, because we've damaged ourselves so badly. So there we have to ask people like Jimmy and others to think again, to listen to the rugby anthem of Scotland, and to go home and think again.
I won't encourage you to speak for the 52%. I do that enough to you, Jimmy.
I feel I should muster some response to what was just said, but
we'll allow that.
Yeah. I suppose I'm interested because, I mean, you've outlined why you thought Brexit was a bad idea, and I'd sort of take your points on that. But I suppose my question to you, and it sort of links back to the discussions we were having about democracy and democratic reform, if a majority of people want to do something that you think that, you know, that expert opinion say thinks is inadvisable, because this is a, you know, that kind of question is at a lot of the seams that we're talking about here, you know, with the COVID response, Brexit, various other problems going on. How do you think that problem should be resolved? Because, you know, you can have education, you can have, as you say, you know, books like yours, podcasts like ours, you can have debate and discussion, but it may still end up at the end of the day that public opinion is still opposed to what expert opinion thinks. So how would you resolve that sort of problem?
Okay, so first I just have to remind you that it wasn't the majority of the population that wanted to leave, okay? It was 26% of the population that we're talking about, 37% electorate. So just we put that in our pipes and smoke.
Sure.
So we thought. But in fact, I addressed this very question, Jimmy, because it's a good point, this one, that needs to be dug into a little bit about how we get from public opinion to government decisions and government action. Now, in a book I published a couple of years ago called Democracy and Its Crisis, I make the point that that there are two very germane considerations here. On the one hand, the people, all adult members, all adult citizens of a society, have a right to a voice. You know, one of the great principles is that government should only be by consent. So everybody has a right to a voice. But no society contains a majority of anything. All societies are collections of minorities who may form temporary coalitions constituting a majority in relation to a given issue at a given time. This is what's forced on our society by elections, where you're given a whole big manifesto and you've got to vote, take it or leave it, and therefore you artificially form a majority out of a collection of minorities. But how do you get from this, you know, variety of opinions and needs and so on? When you go back to Book 8 of Plato's Republic, he's very scathing about the idea of majorities because he says people are ill-informed, short-termist, selfish, not interested in what other people are thinking or needing and so on. So how do you get from that situation, which made Plato think that you can't get democracy, to a democratic order? Answer is that people not only have a right to a voice, they also have a right to good enough government. I use that phrase, good enough government, because of the point I made earlier about nothing being perfect, okay? Actually, Aristotle uses the phrase sufficient government and being realistic. So how do you get from the great variety of voices to sufficient government? Well, a solution was worked out between Locke and Mill. Okay, Mill, in his book, the 1862 book on representative government, had developed the idea, and this is all the way through Montesquieu and the founding fathers of the US and, Benjamin, all these people, the idea of representative government, that the electors will choose people to go to the legislature and there get the facts, debate, listen to argument, consult with one another, and decide what to do in the interests of those they represent. So representative government is the answer to trying to find out what is best overall, given that great diversity of opinion. In a representative democracy, which putatively this is, despite its rubbish electoral system, referendums should never happen. I mean, a referendum is denying the fact that consideration, debate, getting the facts, mature, evolved decision-making procedures on behalf of everybody, taking into account that diversity of opinion, is what should provide us with an alternative with government, which if the people in the end don't like it, they can kick them out and try again. Now, back in 2017, when the Article 29 trigger was being debated in Parliament, the majority of MPs were Remainers, majority of them. So you would think that on the sort of principle that in a representative democracy, we choose people in the hope that they're going to be a bit more considered and you know, act in a way that Edmund Burke famously said, to reflect on behalf of the nation as a whole, as well as on constituents' behalf, that you would get a mature and well-considered result. Why would the majority of MPs Remainers? Because they knew that it was to our very, very great advantage to be in the EU. Well, Brexit, as a result of being triggered, you know, in at the beginning, 1st of January 2020, has now proved to be an incredibly expensive and injurious way of discovering why it is that we should be in the EU.
I maybe have one more question before our time comes to an end, if that's okay, Jimmy, if I'm allowed to do
that. Yeah, you go ahead.
Considering kind of like where our country is at, but also where we are kind of like globally and all of the challenges that we have, are we going to be okay?
And you know, most countries survive. I mean, just look at Europe after the Second World War. Admittedly, it had Marshall Aid, Marshall Plan Aid, to help it recover. But human beings are fairly resilient, and countries come to some sort of new arrangement. If we don't reverse Brexit, which is very much on the cards, but if we don't do it, then we will become a relatively minor, pretty insignificant, small country, small economy, eventually as we diminish, as we're doing it pretty rapidly. And we will find a modus vivendi like that. And you know, in 50 years' time, 100 years' time, we'll, people will be satisfied. You know what they say about the psychology of buying things? You know, you can't make your mind up between two houses. Psychologists would tell you it doesn't matter which one you buy, because you'll have plenty of reasons afterwards as to why it was the right choice. So in the end, you know, in the long term, that's where we'll end up. By the way, I'm very sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about technology, because that's a bit of a...
My question actually, I think, was more about like the big themes of your book, actually, was kind of like with climate change, the rapid kind of like expanses in technology and the problems around like justice. Is that, are maybe not us, but are like our kids are going to be okay? Do you think that, I said it was optimistic because you have kind of like a solution to these problems in a way. Do you think that that idealism is going to come to fruition?
Well, look, it's a really, really interesting question, actually, Jazza, because the answer is twofold. It's not going to be okay from our point of view. I mean, from how we see things now and what we value and regard as important now, the future is not going to be okay. It's going to be worse.
All right, then. Well, thank you for coming.
No, hold on. the people living then, they will be like the house buyer. Mm-hmm. They will find some justification for thinking, well, it ain't too bad. But that's sad in a way, because it would be a very diminished version of not too bad.
Oh, no.
It's interesting that you say that, because I was reading a section of your book just before we started this. And you said, you know, I think I'm right in saying that you subscribe to the view that there is a kind of, there are better and worse forms of like human human morality. There's better ways of achieving higher standards of human well-being and lower standards of human well-being, which to me, you're talking about a kind of objective morality and objective things to pursue in different societies. There might be different ways of achieving similar ends, but the ends are quite well defined, a kind of rejection of moral relativism. I think I'm right in saying. So how does that square with what you've just told us there? I mean, you could sort of say, in a way, nothing matters if people are going to be equally satisfied with anything at the end of the day.
No, in fact, I ended up by saying that it would be a very diminished kind of situation that they find themselves persuading themselves that they're satisfied with. And that is consistent with this objectivist view that I take, because you're right. I mean, I do think that there are some objective considerations that anchor our moral thinking. You know, look, there are very, very few people on the planet who like to be cold, hungry, in pain, denied opportunities, locked up in a small cage, etc. And people who do like that are weird. Okay, so this gives us a really basic sense of you know, how things are better being. It's better that people, not too many people, are cold and hungry and in pain and what have you. When we see people who are in those circumstances, it tells us something about what we might do in response. These are facts about human nature, human experience, and the possibility of suffering. Indeed, facts about animal life, sentient life in general, which should have some impact on how we behave. And for those reasons, I think there is an objective, naturalistic basis to moralities. By those measures, if people in future generations have fewer opportunities, higher levels of cold, pain and hunger, and what have you, because of things that we've done now. If they live in a devastated landscape, devastated by terrible wars and by climate change and so on, then by our standards, the future is not going to be good. But my response to Jezza was that people in that predicament will themselves find ways of persuading themselves that things are just fine.
Fair enough.
Cool. thank you, AC Grayling. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has been such a privilege. You've been great.
Thank you for having me on. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.
Everybody go and buy the book. Okay. Bye-bye now.